a moment is coming of like sheer terror. Like people are gonna be like, oh, like holy cow. Like, so capital's leaving, rates have stopped going down, inflation's picking up because, oh, by the way, the tariffs are, they're not being absorbed by China. Where's that money going to go? You know, some of it will go to, you know, what we see, but I think it starts, some of it starts going into Bitcoin. I think that'll be a really interesting moment when you start seeing, you know, not just some outperformance, but a literal divergence. And that makes perfect sense because once you cross the Rubicon, and we did, you don't come back.
What Bitcoin Did is brought to you by our lead sponsor and massive legend, Iron, the largest NASDAQ-listed Bitcoin miner using 100% renewable energy. Iron are not just powering the Bitcoin network, they also provide cutting-edge computing resources for AI, all backed by renewable energy. So whether you're interested in mining Bitcoin or harnessing AI compute power, Iron is setting the standard. Visit iron.com to learn more, which is iren.com. Luke Groman, great to see you again.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
How's everything been going? I've been watching a lot of the of your interviews. I tend to watch pretty much everything you do, and it seems like you're about as bearish as I've ever heard you.
Yeah, it's been a while. Probably most so since in the near term, at least since right around, call it April of 2022, when I came into 22 thinking, nah, there's no way they're going to hike because they haven't inflated away enough of the debt yet. And it was like, oh, they're going to hike. This is going to be a disaster. And so I pivoted and it was a disaster. And it didn't, you know, a lot of how I thought it would play out sort of did. It basically got inflation down for a bit with the trade-off of getting us to where we are now, which is sort of in even worse fiscal shape in a more acute manner. And in the same kind of way, I've been pretty vocal over the last 3-4 months. Look, if you want a Doge, great. I'm a big supporter of efficiency. And if you're going to Doge, you better get that the GDP down significantly first, or else you're going to create the worst financial crisis, the worst economic crisis problem since 2022 and arguably since 2008. And came into the year thing, you know, just saying, look, I want to be low over my skis for the first 2-3 months of the year, kind of see how it plays out. And as we sit here today at the end of that 3-month period, I want to continue to be low over my skis for the next 2-3 months because they didn't follow the order of operations. It is creating problems in the real economy. It has started to create a problem in the stock market. The fiscal situation is at least as bad as it's been, and we can touch on that, if not getting possibly worse. We'll see. You know, given what we're seeing in stocks in the real economy, you would expect that it will. So yeah, it's I don't think it's a time to be brave.
So, and what is like your big, does it all kind of come back to the sovereign debt issue? And we're just way too extended on that.
Ultimately, yes. And in particular, as it relates to the what I call true interest expense relative to receipts, right? So it's the debt is what it is, but the real issue is U.S. interest plus entitlements is more than 100% of receipts. And receipts are at all-time highs, literally, and it's still over 100% of receipts and growing at a multiple of GDP. And so the elephant in the room is you got to get debt down, or you got to get entitlements down, and the entitlements are politically toxic. And so you got to get that the GDP down fast. So they haven't, and that's really the issue that creates the problems.
So I want to get into all of that. But one thing that really confuses me that I'd like your take on is, obviously, Scott Bessent's come in, Howard Lutnick's come in. They're both very smart. They've had really good careers, and they must see this. And like the way they're acting is a little bit unusual, and it kind of has brought up these theories that are a bit further out there, but I don't know if you can put any credence in it. Like, are they potentially doing things that will drive the equity market down to save the bond market? Are they just letting things get so out of control they can step in and do something really drastic? Like, what's your take on all those kind of more out there theories?
I've seen both of those. I mean, I said to someone recently, I said, look, you know, if the plan here is to trigger a worse financial crisis than what we saw in 2008 is a means of creating the political cover to do what, you know, some of the more extreme types of things from an economic standpoint that you need to do in terms of devaluing debt and kind of resetting the system, then keep doing what you're doing, because that's, you know, that they need to keep doing what they're doing, because that will get them there. Now, yesterday on the All In podcast, Bessent said, you know, we can't go too fast because we want to land the plane. And the inference I took from that is if we go too fast, we're going to crash the plane. And that is a bad thing. And so that would suggest, A, that he knows that going too fast will crash the plane, and B, crashing the plane's a bad thing. And I think he is far too, not only is he far too smart, but he said his mentor is Stan Druckenmiller. He said that on the All In podcast, and I think that's common knowledge.
Yeah.
Druckenmiller gave an interview with Kirill Sokolov in 2019, in which he pointed out the counter-cyclical dynamic where if you try to cut, you're going to start a recession. And if you have a recession, your deficit will actually rise because your counter-cyclical payments will rise. So he has to know that as well. So I don't know if the plan is, you know, drive it into the ditch to sort of, you know, kitchen sink the numbers and blame it all on Biden. Because I think they understand that is, you know, with the amounts of leverage involved, that isn't sort of a bumpy landing. That is into the ground at 400 miles an hour, nose down. And then you're scaring the equities into the bond market. I think there is probably some element of that at work. I understand why that's a popular theory. I think it can work in the very short run. You know, something that has really grabbed my attention in the last 3 weeks is, look, we've had this downtick in equities we've seen since whatever, late February, mid-February. And for the first 10 days or so of it, hey, it worked great. Equities down big, yields down big on the 10-year. After Bessent and said, hey, we're focusing on the 10-year yield. That's the number we got to focus on. And then something interesting happened starting around February 25th, which is 10-year yield stopped going down. Like, we had the equity market go down another 5-7% as measured by the S&P 500 on high volatility. And the 10-year's gone from 4.24 to 4.32, today back to 4.24, even though the Fed yesterday promised we're going to stop selling an extra $20 billion of treasuries beginning on April 1. And that's a problem. That's a huge problem.
So why do you think that's happened?
I think it's a couple things. I think mechanically, it goes back to something we've talked about before, something we've written a lot about in our research, which is one of the biggest marginal buyers of treasuries over the last 2-3 years, maybe even a little longer, but certainly the last 2-3 years have been these relative value hedge funds who, you know, borrow a bunch of money. You know, they basically are buying, you know, levered treasuries, which is fine as long as volatility is low and as long as volatility is low everywhere. So if equity vol picks up, it's not like these relative value hedge funds, because they're multi-strategy, they don't say, well, that's just equity vol. We don't have to worry about over here in our treasury book that's levered 5 times, 10 times in some cases, according to some reports in the FT and elsewhere. They get a tap on the shoulder from compliance and like, that's it. Degross. Equity vol is spiking. We're not going to wait around for it to spike in treasuries. And so we've seen repeatedly over the last 5 years, very tight correlations between equity vol and treasury vol. And so I think that's part of it mechanically. I also think part of it is when you look, U.S. equities essentially back the treasury market in a roundabout way, in that the key marginal driver to tax receipts are U.S. equity prices, as intellectually offensive as that is. They've created this system and now they're getting what they wanted good and hard. And so to the extent equities fall and stay down, you can say with an extremely high degree of confidence within 3 to 6 months, your tax receipts are going to start weakening. We saw this in 2022 and 2023, and that means your issuance is going to start to rise on the treasury side. And so I think there's some element of that. And then I think there's also probably, you know, we haven't had the strong dollar or the high oil prices, you know, that we've seen in 2020 through, call it 2024, early 2024. historically over the last 5 years, when dollar gets too high or oil gets too high, treasuries get sold. And we've not seen either of those. So those have sort of been well contained. But we have seen a new wrinkle, which is significant capital outflows out of the United States in a way we haven't seen in a long time. Ever since, you know, basically mid, I date it to around the third week of or fourth week of February, middle of, you know, I think it was 1 a.m. Friday night to Saturday, February 21st to 22nd, the America First Investment Policy memo was put out by the Trump administration. And it essentially says, China, you've got trillions of capital here. We don't want it anymore. Take it and go home.
Mm-hmm. And what are they doing with that capital?
Well, the flows would tell you it's going to Europe, it's going to Asia, it's going to gold, it's going into Chinese stocks, Hong Kong. You know, somebody pinged me recently. They're like, I was in Hong Kong and they said, hey, tell Trump, thanks for making Hong Kong great again, because all this, you know, when they told China to take their money and get out of here, like some of it's going to Hong Kong. So you can see it in the chart. You just run, you know, sort of, you know, the Hang Seng over NASDAQ and Hang Seng over S&P. You know, the German DAX over NASDAQ and over S&P, gold over NASDAQ and S&P, French CAC, like all of these different indices are significantly outperforming, and gold is significantly outperforming. So I think you're seeing this capital outflow out of the United States that has weakened the dollar, and that has helped kind of keep things in the treasury market on one hand more well contained, because too strong a dollar drives yields up. But on the other hand, you're also having capital outflows, which if it goes too far, will also drive yields up, you know, sort of prevents yields from, you know, you say, I want to scare money out of equities into the 10-year so I can refinance the debt. Great. Well, you're scaring money out of equities, but you're also promising to tariff it and tax it and maybe sanction it and what have you. And so some of it's just leaving and going somewhere else.
And so do you think that was a strategic error making that announcement?
It depends on the timeline. In the context of what they are hoping to achieve as of 2028, no. Look, the U.S. has basically been the world's bank / world's laundromat, right? We run deficits, and then the world's wealthy recycle their capital into American markets. And it's great for their countries, and it's great for our, you know, Washington and Wall Street. And it's not as good for the rest of America. If we want to change that, then that flow has to reverse. And so that secularly reverses that flow. Ideally, it will come back or stay here in the form of a investment in a hard asset, productive asset factory, something that drives American jobs. Now, in the shorter run, you know, strategically, if you look out 2028, that has to happen at some point. So I don't think that's a mistake. Where I think there is a it's a mistake. I don't know why. I think a lot of it is just political realities. It's executional mistake. The reality is doing this with debt to GDP at 120% is the wrong order of operations, number one. Number two, you don't have the facilities to set up to say, listen, hey, get your money out of stocks, but we will continue your tax break, or we will give you this huge tax break if you bring the money into, you know, XYZ. And oh, by the way, we're going to offer an incentive to retrain the American workforce. So look, if you want to study welding or other skilled trades in America, it's free. And when you come out, we're going to guarantee that you're going to make $100,000 a year starting minimum with no debt. There needs to be sort of this whole of government approach to this kind of restructuring that has not happened. And I think that's leading to sort of executional risk / mistakes, because we have had some headlines, some flashy headlines of Apple and others saying we're bringing money back. And those are great things. And if you compare it to the money that is left, I don't know that any money on net has come in. If anything, we've probably lost, you know, given what the dollar's done, we've probably lost it. So that's I don't think it's a mistake, but it's the executional. It's not being executed in a manner that is conducive to not having a very severe crisis in 2025.
This episode is brought to you by AnchorWatch. The thing that keeps me up at night is the idea of a critical error with my Bitcoin cold storage. This is where AnchorWatch comes in. With AnchorWatch, you're protected by their time-locked multi-sig vault and with your own A+ rated Lloyd's of London backed insurance policy. You get to hold your keys, AnchorWatch holds the risk. Whether you're worried about inheritance planning, wrench attacks, natural disasters, or your own mistakes, you're protected by AnchorWatch. Rates for fully insured custody start as low as 0.55% and are available for individual and commercial customers located in the US. Speak to AnchorWatch for a quote and for more details about your security options and coverage. Visit anchorwatch.com today, which is anchorwatch.com. This episode is brought to you by River, the best place for Bitcoiners and businesses to buy Bitcoin. With River, you can set up zero-fee recurring buys, making stacking sats effortless. And while you're waiting for the perfect buying opportunity, River lets you earn daily interest on your cash balance paid in Bitcoin, which outperforms most high-yield savings accounts. What really sets River apart is their unmatched dedication to security. You have peace of mind knowing that River has monthly proof of reserves and holds all Bitcoin in multi-sig cold storage. And with US-based phone support, you'll always have someone ready to help. To open an account, go to river.com/WBD and earn up to $100 in Bitcoin when you buy. That's river.com/WBD. Okay, so if we get back to Besant's analogy, he wants to land the plane, not crash the plane. First of all, like, is that possible? And let's say like you woke up tomorrow, Luke, and you have like unilateral control. You can do whatever you want to do. What is the best path here? Like, what should they be doing? And then can they do that?
What they need to do and what they can do, I think, are too far apart, unfortunately, is kind of what I'm coming to. What they need to do is significantly devalue the debt, you know, write gold up to $20,000, put $5 trillion into the TGA, buy back a quarter or more of the treasury market. That's going to be highly inflationary, debt to GDP will be down, reinvest that money into some of the things we just talked about, and away we go. That's effectively sort of a one-time write down on a real basis of the treasury market, of the debt against gold, which is, I bring up not as Bitcoin, because gold's on the books. They can do that right now, right? In theory, Bitcoin could serve that role, but there's simply, it's not on the books, anywhere. Or in the rule books as they apply those rule books. So I would do something like that. And then again, whole of government approach. Fed, you're going to do yield curve control for the next 2 years. We're going to cut rates to, you know, 50 basis points at the front end and 2.5% at 10-year. And we're also going to run big deficits to retrain the workforce. And, you know, these types of, you know, you're basically talking about, you know, kind of laying out a 2-year Manhattan Project / wartime initiative. And that's what needs to happen. And it's not happening. And by the way, part of that's because you need to have capital controls within this. You know, you basically, hey, if you own treasuries, you're going to have cash on 30% of this as we buy back whatever we buy back. And then you can invest here, but you can't do this. And the reality is any source of capital controls of that magnitude amount to a de facto end of the dollar's reserve status as it has been structured since 1971. Doesn't mean it's no longer the dollar reserve status. It means the structure is changing back to something pre-71 with some wrinkles, where gold is actually the de facto reserve asset, not treasuries. So that's what needs to happen. And the reason why it has to be that drastic is, you know, like I you know, we've seen Scott Bessent say, well, we need a detox. And Wall Street has grabbed this detox and they love this detox idea. And, you know, it's so funny to me because, like, everybody forgets why we toxed in the first place, right? Like, you know, why do we need to detox now? Well, in 87, we could have detoxed, but it would have collapsed the system. In 94, but it would have collapsed the system. 98, long-term capital would have collapsed the system. 02 could have done it, would have collapsed the system. 08 could have detoxed, would have collapsed the system. You know, 2018, 2019, repo rate spike. We could have left repo at 8 to 10%, let treasuries reprice at 11, 12. Mortgages reprice at 13, 14, collapse the system. COVID, we could have detoxed, would have crashed the system. Signature Valley could have would have collapsed the system. So, like, it is fascinating to me, this whole, well, we can just detox and it'll be fine. Like, come on. Like, if all of those other small, you know, some of them were smaller, some of them were bigger than what we're trying to do here, would have collapsed the system, and debt is higher and deficits are higher and the demographics are worse and the geopolitical situation is far worse. We're no longer a unipolar power In fact, we just lost a war, a proxy war. How do you think detoxing is not going to be catastrophic? Like, it's, you know, it just doesn't make intuitive sense, let alone when you actually sit down and run through the math and go, oh my God. So that's what I would do. I don't think it's politically possible. And so I think Besson's comments yesterday, talking about how there was, that was the first acknowledgement of like, yeah, we just can't, you know, if we doge too fast, we'll crash the plane. I think it's an important acknowledgement in both directions. It's like, okay, well, we're not going to crash the plane, but like, okay, then sort of the whole political impetus of the first 3 months of this administration are kind of like, what, like, where are we?
Yeah. The Doge thing's interesting to me because like it's a nice wrapper on essentially just austerity. And are we in a position now where austerity just can't work? Like, even if we take that simple part of everything you've just said, are we in a situation where austerity on its own won't even work?
No, it won't work. No, it absolutely won't work because the debt's too high. You know, to do austerity, the sovereign balance sheet has to be in a position where a recession will not credibly threaten the solvency of the sovereign itself. Volcker could be Volcker and Reagan could front load pain because there was no world in which rates would go to a high enough number where the treasury market would dysfunction, where treasury auctions would fail, where the U.S. government's interest expense would be more than its receipts and it goes into a debt spiral. We're already in a spot where the interest and interest-like obligations are greater than receipts, with receipts at all-time high. And austerity will absolutely take receipts down. So you'll be even further below 100% or further above 100% in terms of your interest and interest-like obligations. So the political cost is too high. And then the math simply won't work. I mean, you've got to get that debt down first. You know, we used in our recent, in a recent report, and we've highlighted this before, you know, the last hegemon that had the reserve currency that tried to doge after it lost a war, had run up its debt and had been deindustrialized and suffered a series of financial crises over multiple decades was the UK after World War One. And they said, you know what, we're going to go back to pre-war parity on the pound relative to the dollar, and we're going to take the austerity pain. That's what we're going to do. And horribly, horrifyingly, the UK lost 6% of its adult age men working force in World War One. 6%. And so taking that 6% away out of the workforce, the UK doing Doge austerity after World War One to try to sort of deflate, UK unemployment was never below 7% from 1921 to 1940. And that was without, you know, that was on a gold standard for the first half of that. And what, and was 6% of the working force killed in this horrible war in the decade prior. So really the number was unemployment never went below 13% for 20 years. There's, and, you know, politically you started to have some of the fallout from that as you got into the late 20s around, I forget the guy's name, but he was in Peaky Blinders as sort of a plot for one season. But it was, you know, the Fascist Party and the Communist Party were starting to make real inroads,
yep,
in the UK as a result of the unemployment situation and the economic situation. So politically, it's not possible. But more importantly, like, they didn't have a debt-based system. They didn't have a debt-based banking system. Like, the mathematically, it wouldn't take 20 years. It wouldn't take 10 years. It probably wouldn't take a year in terms of just the fallout. And so it keeps taking you back to the same point, which is, I don't understand the game at foot. Either they're trying to drive it into the ground to clear the decks, which, again, I don't think that's the plan, or just politically, they can't do what they need to do because it's so complex. That's probably the better base assumption.
So are we kind of at a crossroads here where the US dollar system, as we know it, like, can't really carry on, and they're going to have to move to kind of a neutral reserve asset, whether that's gold or, obviously, in like these circles, people talk about Bitcoin? Or do you think they'll be able to just keep kicking this can, things will progressively get worse, and the dollar system will remain relatively similar to what it is today?
I don't think it's going to remain similar. And I think that's sort of the whole point of the Trump administration, right? When you're that's the other, you know, another fascinating thing about sort of what Besant had to say, which is like, well, you know, we're not, everyone kind of came right to me. Hey, Luke, they said they're not going to revalue the gold. I said, well, they're not going to, said today, we're not going to revalue the gold. You know, 6 weeks ago, he said Trump wasn't going to harass the Fed anymore about rates either. And that lasted a whole 6 weeks. So let's, you know, let's take that with a grain of salt. But setting that aside, he echoed what Trump and Vance and Mirren have all discussed, which is a 180 degree reversal of the flows of capital and trade that have defined the dollar system. You know, we're, you know, what are we telling people defense wise? We're not defending you anymore. Defend yourselves. Okay, that's gone. We want to put tariffs up. We want to drive most of our revenue out of tariffs. That's not the dollar system. You know, take your capital and go home. We don't want China recycling its surpluses and trade with us into our capital markets anymore. Go home. That's a reversal. So I think we are moving towards a neutral reserve asset system. Gold is certainly acting like it. Bitcoin for the moment is being dragged down by, you know, the historical, the short-term correlations with the NASDAQ. I get it. I fully expect NASDAQ and Bitcoin to separate or to diverge, or yeah, Bitcoin to diverge from the NASDAQ later this year in a more pronounced manner. I mean, you can, if you look at sort of long Bitcoin, short NASDAQ on a 2-year chart, you can see it's like, it's, you know, kind of divert, but I think it you'll see a pronounced divergence later this year. But I think it's in everybody's interest to do that. I think that's what we're moving toward.
Mm-hmm. And so, like, can we get into repricing the gold? Because you said before they could write it up to $20,000 an ounce. How does that actually work? Like, what has to happen for something like that to occur?
They would probably have to make a market in. You know, people have, I think, correctly said that, look, like, you know, they would have to sit there and buy it. You know, basically you're printing, you're creating M2 money supply. You know, could the U.S. do it? Sure. They have a printing press. You know, they can print dollars. Everyone's like, oh, we can always pay all of our debt in dollars because we have a printing press. Well, the same's true of gold. You know, in theory, they could buy all the freaking gold by printing dollars.
So it's literally as simple as them saying, like, come to us, we'll buy it for $20,000 an ounce.
Yeah. Same thing they've been saying with the bonds, right? It's yield curve control. I don't think that's a base case. I think that's a very extreme example. I still do think they will ultimately write up the gold to market. You know, if I was going to be Machiavellian about it, I would take steps to get the price of gold as high as I could get it by the market. You know, let the market do the work for me and then reprice it to that.
So what you're talking about here is the gold that's priced at $42 an ounce or whatever it is on their
right
balance sheet. Okay. So they,
yes,
they write that up to 3,000 or whatever it's at right now. And so then what would they do with that gold once it's written up to that price?
Nothing. It's a gimmicky exchange of paper that deposits $800 billion of money roughly at current prices into the Treasury General account, with which Besant can do any number of things. But for a sovereign facing issuance issues and somebody wishing to term out debt and keep issuance at the long end as low as possible, $800 billion is a lot of money, right? Uh-huh. That's 40% of the deficit on a trailing 12-month basis, 35%.
There's so much in there that I want to ask you about, because obviously this has kind of ties to the Bitcoin strategic reserve that's now been signed. But before we do that, you said then that you talked about Besant wanting to offer like the longer duration bonds. He came out and said that, and then he actually started issuing T-bills again. I'm like a layman in this, but my read on that was, I guess he's assuming that rates go down, so issue bills now and then roll them over into long duration when the interest rates drop. Is that what you're thinking, or is it something different to that?
I think if he would have tried, the 10-year yield would be a lot higher than it is today if he tried to issue in any size. Like, I think a really important piece of context in all of this, two important pieces of context. First is that Yellen obviously moved to the front end, didn't term out the debt, took a lot of criticism, including from Besant over the last year and a half for not doing so. That's context one. Context two is that the Fed has not sold on net a single 10 plus year treasury bond on net. So they probably sold some, but on a net basis, their holdings of 10 plus year treasuries has not fallen since 2010. So if that market is so star-spangled awesome and liquid and deep, why can't the Fed sell any? And so if the Fed can't sell any and Yellen moved it all to the front end, you have to come to one of two conclusions. Either Yellen is stupid and didn't term it out when it was low because she's a complete and total moron. And we know she's not. And we may not agree with, you know, people may not agree with her politics. The woman is clearly very bright. I think she did a very good job of dealing with the reality she was dealt with as a result of sort of stupid decisions our government has made over the prior 20 years. So either she's stupid or 10-year treasury market is nowhere near as deep and liquid as advertised. And any attempt to try to issue at the size that they would have wanted to term it out would have quickly blown out 10-year yields to levels that create a problem. And now we can look on the chart. Every time 10-year yield over the last 5 years, 4 years has gotten near 4.8% to 5%, the wheels start coming off the cart. Equity markets start selling off. So now go back to what we talked about before. Equity markets sell off, treasury markets start selling off more because, again, our biggest buyer has been these levered hedge funds. So they're going to sell treasuries into a market sell-off. And you would quickly get into this sort of death spiral that we started to see occur in 3Q23 and 1Q23 and 3Q22. So what my view of why Bessent got into office and didn't start terming out the debt immediately is I think he got read in and was like, oh. You know, so, you know, he's kind of played it cool of like, well, I just stayed with her plan because, you know, the cost cuts haven't come through yet. And I think that's fair. And if I was in his seat, I'd say the same thing. But like behind the scenes, he's probably, I think that's what happened is he just goes, oh my God, like, what am I supposed to do with this? And that's why I think he's ultimately going to revalue the gold to create balance sheet room for himself. Because like, if he had so much room that he didn't need to do it, start terming it out. Go ahead, like knock yourself out. And that hasn't happened yet.
And so if we just assume that, like, I agree with you wholeheartedly that he's saying that he's not going to reprice the gold today. I think that doesn't mean he's not going to do it in 6 weeks' time. But let's just assume that reality for now. Like, how can he drive a market for longer duration bonds if he without repricing gold? Or is that impossible?
In the short run, it's not impossible. But it's a very self-limiting strategy for multiple reasons, right? So if you look at his public pronouncements over the last 12 to 18 months around this topic, it's more recently sort of, hey, we're going to detox and slow the economy and private, and right, we're going to knock stocks down to drive a bid for bonds. Great, you did that and you got 10 trading days out of it and then the 10-year stopped going down. Now what? Okay, well, the Fed just said we're going to stop selling as many. Okay, great. That was good for another, what, 2 basis points? We went over 4 basis points. We went from 4.28 to 4.24. Great. Now what? Well, we're going to go to Europe and say, hey, we're going to pull our defense umbrella if you don't term out your debt 50 years. Hey, Japan, same thing. And like, I think a very underappreciated plot twist of the last week or two has been Europe going like, you know, bugger off. Like, fine, mm-hmm. Give us our money back. We'll buy it ourselves. And the it was an article last week in FT or earlier this week in the FT, like Asian defense makers stocks are soaring because the Europeans are showing up and being like, hey, you know, all the stuff you make for the Americans anyway, make it for us. Because it reminds, I don't know if you've seen the Bruce Willis movie, Armageddon. You know, there's the Russian cosmonaut stranded in space, right? And he's like, you know, Russian components, American components, all made in Taiwan. And it's like, it's kind of the same thing. It's so like plot, you know, the next strategy was, well, we're going to term out the debt for 50 years based under this defense umbrella. Well, like number one, the Europeans are saying, give us our money back. We'll do our own defense thing. That's not helping drive yields down. If anything, you know, German Bund yields are up and actually looking like they're going to pull 10-year treasury yields up. Same thing with 10-year JGB yields in Japan. And I think it's another one of the sort of these underreported stories. Like Mark Rutte, the Secretary General of NATO, 2 months ago, not even, said, look, you know, Russia's outproducing all of NATO 4-1. You know, wow. Eric Prince, who runs Blackwater, came out in the last week or two and said, listen, 3 years ago, if you took a shot at the Russians in Ukraine, it would be about with an artillery shell, it would take them an hour and a half to shoot back at you. Now, when you shoot, you better have your ASS in a car running because they're going to have something on you in 2 minutes. Like, there is the defense umbrella. I don't think looks as attractive after the last 3 years. The American defense umbrella and the performance of conventional weapons, certain conventional weapons systems on a relative basis, I don't think look as attractive or they carry as much leverage in terms of terming out our debt as they did 2-3 years ago. And I don't think that has been digested by Wall Street at all. But it will be. It will be. And so, the point for our purposes here is, okay, well, knocking stocks down had a very short shelf life. And the longer you go with that, the more it's not going to work because you're going to hit receipts. You're going to have to increase issuance. The economy is going to slow. God forbid if you drive yourself into a recession because now your issuance is going to blow up by 1.5 to 2 trillion, maybe more, just based on a run-of-the-mill, plain vanilla recession and sort of what deficits do in those. The sort of defense umbrella thing is starting to kind of look a little eh. The whole Europeans paying for it, you know, they're taking their money and going home on the margin. And so if I'm sitting there in their shoes, you know, again, it goes back to sort of this executional thing. I think their target, their strategic goal makes perfect sense. I think it's great for America. I think it's great for all Americans at both sides of the party. But the risk was always going to be the execution and the political ability to do some of the things they needed to do to execute. And that has quickly, you know, getting bogged down in the mud.
So to kind of like left side of the bell curve, this is this really like the US trying to find its place in a changing world order? And was kind of the start of that, the sanctions on Russian treasuries?
I do think it's us trying to find our place in a new world order. I think some of it is the recognition by Washington, corporate America, and Wall Street circa, I don't know, 2017, 2018, something around there, a sort of oh my God moment where they started to realize that they were falling behind China in a lot of key ways. That was where I think it started to hit home. And then I think COVID reinforced that with the inability to get supplies. And then I think the Russia, you know, number one, that we were outproduced by the Russians as badly as we've been outproduced. And then the performance of some of these weapons systems. Like I've been told, like, look, we've got the best weapons in the world and they've underperformed the good enough weapons, you know, and, you know, in wartime, you know, quantity has a quality all its own. So I think it's that recognition that the sort of benefits of globalization, of lower costs and lower labor costs, and this have gone too far on a number of different fronts. And they're trying to kind of reverse that. But the problem is it's like, you know, it's like fixing one of the fins on Elon's rockets, you know, while it's like leaving orbit, right? Like it's, you know, and you're hanging out there holding on, trying to tighten us. So, like, hold on, let me bolt this thing on and move it over a couple inches. Like it's very difficult to do. It's the executional risk is very, very high.
So if they've now like realized, or at least some people in the administration have realized that maybe a move to kind of like a neutral reserve asset is the right move. Do they have a bigger kind of geopolitical advantage of making that gold or Bitcoin? Because like, if you tried to follow the incentives, presumably they're going to go for whichever one gives them the biggest advantage.
Short answer is yes. The short answer is yes. Longer answer is, I think some of our adversaries have front run us on this.
On both gold and Bitcoin.
I would be shocked, and I've had people that I respect say, Luke, you should be shocked if China hasn't been stacking Bitcoin on an official capacity on the QT for multiple years.
Right, totally.
Ditto Russia. So I'm the theory of it is yes, we would have an advantage. And I think ultimately, you know, in theory, yes. practically right now, no, maybe not, right? If they've already stacked it, then maybe there isn't one. I don't know. Ultimately, you could make the case that, you know, we can produce that you're better that something like a Bitcoin, where there is a hard cap on the supply and a shrinking stock to or a rising stock to flow over time, gives you a better incentive and ultimately drives a it drives it in a competition in a pure sense of where is your best rule of law, where is your best productivity, because the guy who's got best productivity and forget about rule of law, I mean within reason, best productivity is going to win, right? He's going to be the guy earning Bitcoin net. Some of that's the currency against Bitcoin will fix all that, right? Like it should balance over time. So you could make that case, then that gets us back to another area of executional risk, right? Of internationally, the real politic is who's got the best weapons and the nukes and who's the creditor and who's willing to go all the way to the mattresses and can credibly threaten others. And you get into sort of the Game of Thrones from sort of a, blackmail slash intrigue slash, black ops slash thermonuclear war all the way up the scale, like trying to figure that out. So I can see the theory of it. I can see, but who knows?
Okay. Cause like if everything is kind of leading back to repricing the gold, maybe actually, first of all, why is the gold at $42?
that was the price it was when we closed the gold window.
But why have they never repriced it before? Is it down to like it's politically unfavorable to do that? Like, what's the reason it's still there?
So I have heard two reasons. The first is that if they repriced it, they basically would put it back on the table, and that would be eligible to be claimed by primarily European creditors as having been defaulted on under Bretton Woods. I don't know the verity of that. If those treaties are still in place, what have you? I've heard that. I think it's the more plausible or the cleaner explanation, and maybe they're both true, I don't know, is just the dogma of it. That basically, once we took it out of the system, we just didn't want to talk about it, right? It's sort of like the dirty secret in the closet. You just shove them away and never talk about them again. And I think it's, that's part of it, if not most of it.
Yeah, that makes sense. But that also seems like something Trump and Elon and the rest of them maybe wouldn't actually care about, which probably makes it more likely that they're going to reprice it. So in Bitcoin circles, like with this executive order, obviously the caveat is they can acquire Bitcoin as long as it's in a budget neutral way. And one of the ways that they can potentially unlock a lot of money and do that is by repricing their gold. Maybe like start with, I'd like your take on the strategic reserve and what you think of it. And then do you think that that's even like a potential outcome, or do you think they're not likely to reprice it and buy Bitcoin?
I don't think they would use the whole proceeds simply because when your house is on fire and someone gives you a fire truck, full of water, like you don't take it out back and fill the swimming pool in case in case the weather's warm, right? Or in case you need it for the future, right? You spray it and put out the fire. And, $800 billion would buy operating room for the better part of a year, maybe a year and a half, well into the, very close to the next midterms. So, maybe they would do some on the margin. Maybe they, if they did it, $20 billion, $50 billion, sort of a nod, and then they can sort of tweet, promises kept kind of a thing. I don't think it's going to be a big number simply because, again, to go back to that initial point, like true interest expense is over 100% of receipts with receipts at all-time highs. And with all these other things happening, the Europeans taking their money back, your Chinese taking their money back, like it's a very tricky situation. And so taking the $800 billion and taking half of it and throw it into Bitcoin, I don't see how that, but I think that in the long run, it might be, it probably is very, very much the smart thing to do. But again, it's like, you know, it's like filling up your pool with your house on fire. It just, they don't have the operating room right now.
This episode is also brought to you by Ledger. If you're serious about protecting your Bitcoin, Ledger has the solution you need. Their hardware wallets give you complete control over your private keys, ensuring that your Bitcoin stays safe from hacks, phishing, and malware. With Ledger's easy-to-use devices and the Ledger Live app, managing your Bitcoin has never been more convenient. Whether you're a long-time holder or new to the world of Bitcoin, Ledger makes it simple to keep your assets protected. If you want to find out more, visit ledger.com and secure your Bitcoin today. That's ledger.com. This episode is brought to you by Casa, the leading Bitcoin self-custody solution. I've been using Casa since 2019, and I can't recommend them enough. Casa have options for all Bitcoiners, from a 2-of-3 multisig to a 3-of-5 and a private client option for absolute best-in-class security. Casa also do inheritance, which I very recently set up, and it really couldn't be easier. My inheritance plan has gone from a vague treasure map for my wife to a rock-solid security plan that I have total confidence in. To find out more about Casa, go to casa.io, which is casa.io. Okay. One other bit on Bitcoin that I wanted to ask you about is I heard you on another show recently saying you were not bearish on Bitcoin, but a little more bearish on Bitcoin, mainly because of how it's trading kind of just like the NASDAQ. Do you want to expand on that point? I'd be interested to hear that.
Yeah, that's just straight capital flows. That's, you know, February 21st, China, you know, Trump came out and said, take your money home, China. We don't want to hear anymore. And, you know, it's fascinating to me that people don't realize the biggest China Belt and Road hub in the world is the NASDAQ. There's trillions in Chinese capital sitting in there. And if it's leaving, I think you're going to see a lot, sort of a drag down period, especially given the valuations we're talking about, right? It's not like the NASDAQ's trading at, you know, low valuations, multi-year lows. Like it's in sort of la-la land. And like you literally just told trillions in capital go somewhere else. And so I think the NASDAQ will be sort of in this drawdown period that we've seen over the last, I mean, we're only a month into this.
Uh-huh. It's crazy.
And so I think it's going to continue for a while. You know, and it doesn't necessarily need to be a crash, but I just think it's going to kind of like tick, 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 like it's done over the last month. And look, every trader on the planet is like, look, it trades like a tech stock. It trades like a tech stock, trades like a tech stock. It trades like a bank stock too, by the way. You know, they leave that part out. The BKX, the NDX, the NAS, and Bitcoin like are all right together, right? But my expectation, my view, my hope, maybe, because, you know, it is a big position for me, is I do, it's a neutral reserve asset. It isn't a tech stock. It isn't a bank stock. And as the factors that I see that we talked about earlier developing, where I think a moment is coming, if they don't really sort of do something big in terms of devaluation, which, oh, by the way, will be really good for Bitcoin, in my opinion. If they don't do that pretty quickly to get that to GDP down, like a moment is coming of like sheer terror. Like people are going to be like, oh, like, holy cow. Like, so capital's leaving, rates have stopped going down, inflation's picking up because, oh, by the way, the tariffs are, they're not being absorbed by China. China's telling American retailers to, you know, bugger off. And so those are, oh my God, where's that money going to go? You know, some of it will go to, you know, what we see, but I think it starts, some of it starts going into Bitcoin. I think that'll be a really interesting moment when you start seeing, you know, not just some outperformance, but a literal divergence. Because look, like we saw that with gold forever. Hey, gold's just a play on real rates, real rates, real rates, real rates. And then in 2022, they went like that and they've never come back together. And that makes perfect sense because once you cross the Rubicon, and we did, you don't come back. And I think we're going to cross a Rubicon with the NASDAQ and Bitcoin. That's all it is for me, is it's just, you know, I've got clients that are sort of all across the board in terms of like time horizons. And so I try to be like, I tell them what I'm doing. I've got a longer term time horizon, but I want to, you know, I always reflect like, hey, if you had a short term time horizon, like I think NASDAQ's going down and maybe relatively rapidly. And in the short run, that's probably not going to be good for Bitcoin. And that's what that's a reflection of. That has nothing to do with anything other than that.
So it's just, it's long term bullish, still short term, a little bit more bearish. But when it comes to like the world understanding what Bitcoin is, like I don't see Bitcoin as a risk on asset or even like a risk off asset. It's just like a forever asset for me. Do you think it's going to take a moment of this like crisis to convince the world that that's what Bitcoin is?
I think it's going to take that to convince Western paper traders, Western traders, right? Western short-term traders. Because I think if you go to the average, emerging market participant who's, you know, lived through a high inflation, like you say, hey, would you be interested in money that can't be confiscated? You can move anywhere globally and it hedges your, you know, inflation. And they're like, yes, please. And twice on Sundays, right? Like, and like what I'm discussing here really, you know, and this is blasphemy to say, blasphemous to say, we're talking about the United States of America heading towards an emerging market sudden stop crisis, right? Like that is capital leaving, rates up, inflation picking up.
It's terrifying.
It's terrifying. I've never lived through one, but my understanding and reading about them in emerging markets is like, yeah, you get your money out of dollars if you can. You get your money into gold if you can. You get your money into Bitcoin if you can. And I think that's kind of like the, you know, sort of, you know, I jokingly said this the other day to someone on X. So like over the last 20 or 25 or 30 years, like sort of, you know, it's, you know, a good way, a good theme or narrative to fade, you know, to bet against and make money is the narrative of, well, it's different this time because we're America. So all the history won't matter. And then you're like, oh, wait, you know, so I said, you know, I know, you know, home prices have never fallen nationally. Oh, you know, printing a bunch of money won't be inflationary. Oh, you know, Afghanistan is the graveyard of empires, I know, but oh, you know, hey, fighting Russia in their backyard is a bad idea, but we're America. Oh, like, and so you sort of have, you, yes, these are all the makings of a sudden stop. Capital's leaving, inflation's bottoming, you know, tariffs are being absorbed by us, rates are bottoming, like, but we're America, it won't matter. And like, on current course and track, unless something really changes, I think a moment's coming in the next 3 to 6 months. It's like, oh, that's why all of the people in Argentina and Turkey and, you know, these Latin American, Brazil, like Bitcoin so much. Oh, okay. Now I get it.
I mean, that is terrifying because like, I obviously want Bitcoin to do really well. Like I couldn't be more all in Bitcoin. So this is like something like that would be great for me. But at the same time, I don't want to see Bitcoin do really well while everyone else is getting absolutely crushed. But that's kind of like the picture you're painting, which is pretty bleak. Everything we've kind of spoken about there has been very like big picture. If we brought that back to like a more individual basis, what do you think the next like year, 5 years is going to look like? Are we going to see inflation rip again?
Yeah, I think so. My only question is it, do we get like a brief whoosh down first and then ripping inflation, or, you know, they're trying to land the plane, you know, but, you know, they're sort of reaching stall speed. And once they reach stall speed, it's not like you just go down like this. You hit stall speed and then you go, whomp. And so I can't tell if it's whomp and then they hit the jets and go, or if it's just, and then, you know, pick back up. In the end, you know, that's a matter of positioning. That's a matter of leverage. If you're on leverage, you don't care. If you're not reporting monthly or quarterly numbers, you don't care. I think it's going to be higher. And it has to be like this. There's only three ways. I don't want to sell short the other. There's only three ways you get out of these debt situations historically. I mean, we are in a once in 100-year debt cycle and you either default. And again, default is a nominal write down of some description. And unlike any other time in history, this is one way it definitely is different this time, is the entire system, you know, the sovereign debt is the collateral backing the banking system. So if you write down the debt, the entire banking system's undercapitalized. And so if they do that, then all of a sudden you're gonna have two choices: print the money to bail out all the banking system, inflationary, or hey, everybody with a deposit over 250,000 in any bank in America, congratulations, everything over 250 goes poof in every individual account. What do you think is going to happen then?
And now, they showed during the Silicon Valley Bank thing that they're not, or they at least weren't willing to let that happen. Whether this is different,
I don't
know.
They can't let that happen. They can't. And to be clear, like, I'm being hyperbolic for the example, for the illustrative purposes, it would be much more like, you know, Silicon Valley. Okay, they could have kept selling treasuries to pay out their depositors. And that would have put more upward pressure in treasury yields, which would have caused losses elsewhere in treasury and duration across the banking system, and started raising questions elsewhere. And then it feeds on itself. And once it, again, these things are nonlinear. And yeah, they showed you, they just preempted that. So the nominal default isn't going to happen. Let's just take that one and move that over here. So then you're left with inflation or productivity miracle, right? You've got to have a significant period of negative real interest rates. And, you know, it's fascinating to me. It's kind of like the detox intox thing, right? Well, we're detoxing. Well, why are we detoxing when, you know, look at all the other intoxing things we did, right? Same kind of thing where we compared COVID to World War II. We compared, you know, we compared Putin to Hitler and, it's like, you know, 1938 again, blah, 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 blah. Great. Then why in 2020 didn't you do what we did from 1945 to 51? Which is yield curve control, capital controls, bondholders get killed. Real rates in the US were negative 13% at their lowest. In Japan, they were at negative 60% at their lowest. Australia, they were negative 30. Italy, you know, basically the losers, they were really bad. And, you know, they were only in the teens or 20s or 30s in the winners. And you, for example, US debt to GDP went from 110% in 1946 to 55 in 1951. And that's the thing they don't like to talk about. And there's a reason why they don't like to, right? Is like, it's uncomfortable and politically probably very difficult, if not impossible to do without a huge crisis. But like, don't give me like half of the World War II. Oh, we need to do world. It's like a war. Well, finish the analog. So that's inflationary. Like, we're going to get to that point at some point, one way or another. Like, that's coming. That's on the come. Because that's the only way out of this. The last one is productivity miracle. You can, in theory, do that. The UK did that after the Napoleonic Wars in the 1800s in a wildly different time. The challenges, you know, with productivity miracles, especially now, is it would have to be a productivity miracle where people don't lose their jobs and people don't have their wages not grow because, you know, and after the Napoleonic Wars, it was not a debt-based system. There was not this proliferation of consumer loans everywhere, right? So like we get a productivity miracle where robots and AI, you know, replace 20% of the workforce and they promptly stop paying their mortgages and their car loans and the banks have trouble and they start, right? We're right back there, which then gets back to like all roads lead to inflation. All roads lead to the some sort of crisis driving the full reserving of the debt market, right? You know, ultimately, that's where AI and robotics go, is they're going to have to fully reserve the debt market to prevent the banks from collapsing because of the productivity from AI and robotics. And to me, that's a big part of the reason I own Bitcoin and gold. But like, if they're going to have to fully reserve the banking system because of productivity and technology, and all credit to this line of thinking goes to Jeff Booth. Like, Bitcoin's actually, to me, the cleanest AI play.
Yeah,
by far.
And there's an interesting element there where, like, if we do get this world where we have a billion AI agents and they need money, like Bitcoin also fits into that perfectly.
Absolutely.
But so it was probably a little over a year ago you were on the show and you were talking about there being like a non-zero chance that we get like high double digit, even triple digit inflation for a short period of time to try and wipe out this debt to GDP. Do you still think that's like on the cards?
Yeah, I think it's when you ask me, like, what would you do? That's what I would do. That's the only, you know, the longer you delay this, the more compressed and high, right? So you've got to basically go through a period, you know, we'll say that it's a shape of, you know, 5 years of negative 12% rates, we'll say, right? Or you can do 1 year of negative 150% rate.
And just rip the Band-Aid off.
Right. Something like that. I don't think you can do you know, I don't even know if you can do 5 at negative 12 anymore. I think you could have gotten away with it. I think you started to do it after 20, and then they chickened out when it got to, you know, 8% CPI officially and probably higher than that unofficially, and midterms came. They wussed out, bottom line. Like, paradoxically, if Powell wanted to be brave like Volcker, he would have done nothing. He would have sat there and taken the heat and let inflation get to 15, like get the, they got that the GDP from 130 down to 117, 116. He should have let it run hot, let it get down to 80, and then cranked, then done the old time Volcker, you know. That was the brave thing. What he did was the politically expedient thing. And I don't blame him. It just is what it is. So I don't think sort of 5 years at negative 12 is even on the table anymore for the reasons we talked about, without capital controls. And I definitely don't think, you know, 10 years at negative 5 or negative 3% real rates, because it just, the number, it, you know, you're too far gone in terms of the demographics on the entitlements and stuff.
But what if no one is brave enough to do this? What happens then? Like, what does the market actually do if no one's brave enough to make a decision like that?
That's a good question.
Like, is the money printer just the easy option, like the easy way out of for this always?
I think you're just going to see more and more of what we've gotten, which at faster and faster intervals, which is you have, you know, in theory, right now we're seeing a change in behavior of the dollar because the capital outflows are overshadowing the what had been dominating dollar performance, which was crowding out effective dollar markets, right? And every other time, this is like, the dollar is falling with true interest expense above 100% because so much capital is flowing out over the last month, month and a half. I think you're going to, you know, you're going to continue to get these periods of treasury market dysfunction. You're going to need more and more, you know, you'll see what we saw yesterday, which is Powell coming out and being like, well, we're going to take, you know, we're going to QT $25 billion a month down to 5 for treasuries beginning on April 1. And, you know, someone pointed out to me yesterday, right at the end of that press conference, he laid out that, you know, they have talked about, at least, he said, we're not there yet, but it's conceivable we could continue to run off the MBS because we want those gone, but stop growing our balance sheet overall, or stop shrinking our balance sheet, keeping it stable, which implies buying treasuries while they're selling, with the proceeds of selling MBS or rolling off MBS, which is, you know, not QE, QE. I mean, the purists will be like, oh, it's not QE.
But it's QE.
I don't care.
Yeah.
It's QE.
And how many mortgage-backed securities do they have on the balance sheet now? Like, how big is that?
Oh, boy. I don't know. The balance sheet is, what, a little under 7? I don't know. I should know it off the top of my head. I don't.
But is it like a quite a lot of money?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's if I had to guess, it's probably a third of it.
Okay.
I would guess, but again, it's, I should know that number. I don't.
Okay. But really, what you're saying is all roads lead back to QE, I guess. And are you thinking this year? Like, is this in the short term?
Yeah, I do, ultimately, because, again, we keep going back to this, you know, the true interest expense number. The fiscal situation is just so problematic. You know, receipts are at all-time highs, markets are just barely rolled over, the economy's softening, foreigners are repatriating their capital. You know, somebody say to me today, made me laugh out loud, Trump has done the impossible. He's gotten Europe to act together. Like, these guys can't agree on what to have to lunch, but they all want to build an army now. It's incredible. I think ultimately, if we don't do that sort of period, we just go from rolling crisis of, and now ultimately they will, you know, crisis better. And it keeps getting kind of what we've seen, right? Which is 19, 20, 22, 23. And pretty soon, at some point, they just kind of lose the market and it doesn't form, right? At some point. And some of it could be like what we're seeing in gold right now. We're just like, you come in, you know, gold goes up on trading days that end in Y. Like, that could be sort of the early, you know, that would be one of the symptoms of what you'd expect to see. Bitcoin separating from the NASDAQ would be another such symptom, where Capitals just goes, they're going to look at this, go, listen, I don't know when they're going to sort of yield curve control or, you know, but the writing's on the wall. And so, you know, we'll see.
And so I've spoken to Lynn Alden relatively recently, and she's been on this kind of fiscal dominance thing for a long time. And again, like my layman perspective of that is it basically just means the Fed's policy makes little difference. If the Fed started doing like a major QE event again, does that take us out of that fiscal dominance era?
I think it's more a nod to it than anything else. I think it's just sort of giving into it, right? Because think about the environment in which that would be happening, right? You know, a dollar that is down from 109 to 103, inflation bottoming, tariffs coming into place. Wow. That could be, you know, that'd be pretty powerful. You know, now if they ultimately, the way you get out of fiscal dominance is you shrink. There's two ways. You raise rates and you do the Volcker, right? You just fire and brimstone. And again, my long-term view on this, and I think the math is bearing this out, you can't do it with debt to GDP at 120% when your receipts are dependent on stocks that you need to kill to find, like, it doesn't yeah. work. It's a snake eating its own tail. So fire and brimstone can't be done. So the only other way to do it is you got to get debt to GDP down significantly to get out of that, because that's really the key marginal, you know, the key marginal driver. You could do it with entitlement reform as well. We're not really seeing anything there, but if you can get the all-in debt to GDP number down with a period of high inflation, which I think the Fed sort of doing QE into, you know, tariffs, et cetera, and capital outflows, that would do it, right? I mean, that would do the trick. I mean, they're equally unpleasant in opposite directions.
Okay. The last thing I'd want to talk to you about is Bitcoin-backed bonds. So we spoke about this in Nashville with Preston on the show. And that was the first time I'd really kind of heard of this idea. And since then, I don't know if you've been kind of keeping tracks on the Bitcoin side of things, but it's become a much bigger narrative. So like Brian Astaire wrote a sort of two-page white paper on this. I was in DC last week at the Bitcoin Policy Institute Summit, and Andrew Hones did a presentation on that in front of like some key policymakers, which is really cool to see. Do you think that A has like a realistic chance of actually happening, and B has like a big impact in the bond market if they do that?
I don't know on the chances. I hope so. You know, Judy Shelton has talked about this on the gold side. And you know, if I interacted a bit with Brian and Preston a bit on the Bitbonds thing. If you look at the chart showing that thing, there's an FFTT thing down at the bottom of the chart, I think. But I absolutely think it could make a big difference, right? And this is one of these things where the inflation necessarily doesn't have to be sort of this system-wide sort of collapse of bonds against everything. This is, you know, you write up Bitcoin, you put a little Bitcoin kicker, you know, would I buy a 10-year treasury with a 2%, 2.5% yield? Let's say two for easy math. Would I buy a 10-year U.S. treasury, 2% yield with whatever, 5% of the face in Bitcoin? Yeah, I'd buy that. And that means you got to go out and buy the Bitcoin, right, to back it, basically, right? Which means, like, the dollar is going to collapse against Bitcoin. Same thing with gold a little bit. I don't know what the right number is on gold to do it. It ain't 3,000. You know, it might be 5 or 6 or 10. But again, you know, someone asked me the same question. It's sort of a different version of the same question. It's like, when would you be, at what yield would you be bullish on 10-year treasury yields? So it's not about the yield of the bond, the price of the bond. It's about the price of the dollar. In other words, relative to gold. You know, historically, you know, if you look at the value of the dollar relative to gold, the value of our debt relative to our gold, it's dirt cheap. You know, gold is dirt cheap. You know, at $10,000 gold, reprice my gold to $10,000, I'll buy some 10-year paper at 2.5%. I'll do that, right? And you, there's different ways you can structure that. And the same thing's true, I think, with the Bitcoin of, like, the risk is the inflation. Like, I, whatever, everything that I have said here today, everything we've talked about is there is no way out. Even a productivity miracle creates a crisis that makes the debt unpayable. So there's really no conceivable range of likely outcomes in which me holding long-term U.S. Treasury paper, and by the way, it's true for British paper, it's probably true for German paper, et cetera, et cetera. I'm going to lose money on a real basis, and I don't like that. But if you ameliorate that risk for me by giving me 5% of the face in Bitcoin, and there's obviously Bitcoin makes it very easy, much easier than gold, to sort of say, like, right, like you can put that in under sort of lock and key, and,
yeah,
and I can
it,
have confidence that that is there versus, you know, hey, trust us, you know. Yeah, that absolutely could be huge. In terms of bond market implications, I really haven't thought through the competitive implications, but I would have to think it would drive capital flows here. I think it would drive spreads higher of it would basically force all the sovereigns to do it. Because I think if you weren't doing it and competing with the Americans who were, your spreads are going to blow out and you're going to have a crisis. So it would be a very, I think it would be a potentially a very big deal. So I hope they're successful, and I think it makes a lot of sense. And it, like, look, I've said all along, like, this ends with a change in the dollar, in the structure of U.S. dollar reserve status. And that would absolutely 150% be a change in the dollar reserve status, right? The dollar would collapse against Bitcoin. Great. Like, perfect. And oh, by the way, what's as Bitcoin rises, what's going to get backfilled? Stable coins? T-bills. Like this, it literally, it's sitting right there at the 2 yard line going in. They just have to hike the ball and, but it's, there's a lot of dogma, what have you. And some of it might be, they need a crisis to do it. I don't know, but I think it makes a ton of sense. I'm a big fan of the idea. I think it would work. Let's hope our policymakers can see the wisdom and prudence in it.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the idea as well. The thing that I'm not sure of is what it means for the dollar. Like, if they did that, does that basically signify the end of the dollar as, like, the world reserve currency?
I don't think it's the end of it. I think it's the end of the post-71 dollar, which is, that's already dead anyway. Like, it's ironic. The last people to get that was dead were the people in Washington and Wall Street.
Yeah.
Right? And they're finally like, oh, we can't get masks. Oh, we can't make weapons. Maybe this is not a good system for us. Like, nice job, guys. Congratulations. Come on in. The water's warm. Welcome to the party. So, like, that system's already dead. Like, this would just be marking it to market. And so it really would be, I find Bessent's comments that he made last year that I want to strengthen the dollar system but weaken the dollar fascinating, because 90%+ of people on Wall Street think those two concepts are mutually exclusive. And the way you sort of split that baby is bit bonds, gold bonds, these type, like, that's one of the ways you can sort of split that baby. The dollar collapses against Bitcoin, but the dollar system strengthens meaningfully. And now you will be talking about a system where Bitcoin is a de facto neutral reserve asset of sorts. If not, you know, explicitly so, being added to other sovereign FX reserve piles, et cetera, perhaps. And if not, if they're buying American bonds that has a Bitcoin attached to it, guess what? Bitcoin's a friggin' de facto reserve asset, just like gold was pre-71. And so it would really be much more like that pre-71 dollar reserve status, where yes, the dollar is a reserve currency, but guess what really is? Bitcoin. Right.
Yeah.
Bit bonds. Right. Yeah. You're buying those bonds. You ain't buying those bonds for the freaking dollars. You're buying those bonds because the dollars plus the Bitcoin. Same thing with gold. You weren't buying the bonds from 45 to 71 because of the friggin' dollars. You're buying them because those dollars were good for gold, where they were supposed to be as good as gold. So that would be the change. And I think that's part of the reason the political dynamic of that change, like that's a big, that's probably a big hurdle in a lot of minds. But again, like, A, that's already, like, it's over. Like, that whole old system is no longer, it's already collapsing. It's not in our interest. It's killing us. And if it's ever going to happen, it's now, right? Like, J.D. Vance was just talking about this week, like, how bad the old system was for us. Trump's talked about it. Bessent's talked about it. Myron's, like, Myron. They, it's all there. So it makes a lot of sense. It would just be a different dollar reserve system.
Just to clarify, when you say it strengthens the system, you mean that's because it actually brings demand back for US-based debt?
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, I hope it happens. I mean, it'd be great for us Bitcoiners. But Luke, you've kind of black-pilled me on the economy there, but I really appreciate the time. It's been a really good chat. Thank you so much for coming on the show again. Where do you want to send anyone before we close out?
Yeah, if they're interested in hearing more about what we have to say, it's fftt-llc.com for more information about our institutional and mass market products, and obviously on X as well, at Luke Groman, all one word.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much, Luke.
Likewise. Thanks for having me on, Danny. It was great talking to you, my friend.